Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Drop your shoulders, take a breath, tune in to how you feel, because it's time to stretch. Hello and welcome back to a new season of Stretch Marks podcast. My name is Sinead O'Moore and I created Stretch Marks to give us all an opportunity to acknowledge the parts of life that are stretching us in all directions. Not just the physical, but the mental, emotional, hormonal, professional, financial, identity, partnership, energetic stretches we all go through. Because there is no right or wrong, there is no picture perfect, there are just a series of stretches, one after the other, that leave their mark. This episode is sponsored by Carrywell, maternity wear that makes breastfeeding and pregnancy as comfortable as possible. Carrywell is the support we need with their maternity and nursing underwear, made specifically for our growing needs before, during, and after pregnancy. Embrace the stretch of motherhood confidently with Carrywell and this podcast.
It is the last in the series, but we're going to finish on a high with Holly Carnes, leader of the Social Democrats, to talk about her stretch as a young woman into politics and her motivations to create positive change. I had a huge reaction online when I said Holly was joining me as a guest. So thank you for being here listening. And I'd love you to share it with your friends and followers. Leave a quick review in Spotify or Apple. All of it makes a huge difference. I, like many women I speak to, have admired Holly's ability to stand in the dull and speak on issues with empathy, humanity, and with a feminine authenticity we don't always see about the things that matter to us. We talk about Gaza, how her view of politics and the world has changed, her experience of sexism, ageism and intimidation, her rise through politics, and why we need more women using their voices, their votes and their value for the world we all hope to see. Holly, thank you so much for joining me on Stretch Marks podcast. Can we start by agreeing that it has been quite the week?
Oh my God, what a week. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. Yeah, it is the end of a kind of what the media describes as an earthquake here in Leinster House, the Taoiseach stepping down. So yeah, it's been very busy.
Can I ask what was your first rumblings of something is happening?
Same as everybody else. Oftentimes people are like, when's the election? I'm like, my guess is literally as good as everybody else's. I've got no inside knowledge to things like that going on in government. In fact, the opposition are the last people they want to know anything. So when I just saw that article pop up that there was going to be earthquake news, that was the first rumbling I heard. It is kind of like, it's quite frantic when something like that comes out, because when the article first came out, it was quite clear that it was going to be Leo Varadkar stepping down. And yeah, I guess first of all, you're like, is there a way this could cause a general election? Like, what's actually going to come from this? And then obviously we were all like gathered to see his announcement, like, why is he stepping down? And yeah, our response obviously is very much based on that, on the circumstances of the resignation and all of that stuff.
If we are to assume that and take him for his word, that it is personal and political and professional, and you can see the wear and tear of politics. You can see the personal toll it takes on you, particularly in a world that has become more toxic, that has become more vocal on social, that you feel like you're attacked for doing anything all day, every day. And particularly as a woman, I feel like, I think we need to have that conversation. I feel like women are also targeted. How did you grapple with your own decisions in getting into politics? You know, it's, to me, I feel like I am highly motivated to want to see action and change and improvement and, you know, momentum. And yet, as a strong-minded, fully functioning woman with ideals, I would also feel incredibly intimidated by stepping into that world.
I think, like, if I'm completely honest, I didn't know what I was getting myself into back then. I was like fresh out of the social referendums and I hadn't any kind of interest in politics. And I just had this real like moment, particularly during repeal, that like this is how we affect change, like knocking on doors, asking for votes. And I just felt so motivated. And like I didn't even think about like loads of aspects of the role, like that quite a lot of it is going out to the media and being on TV and radio and all of these things that I find really like daunting and nerve wracking. And I hadn't fully prepared. So I have to say, I'm glad that I didn't know what I was getting myself into, because like, would I have done it if I knew that? Like, I don't know. It's so much more daunting and I do not regret it for a second. You know, there's lots of times I feel out of my comfort zone and like, how do I grapple with the kind of abuse that politicians get, and particularly women, like not very well. Sometimes I find it really difficult. And I think it's important to be honest about that. Sometimes I'm, yeah, I feel very on edge and nervous and stuff like that. But by so much, there's positives of being in the job as well. So it's really important to highlight them too, because I think there's a lot of kind of coverage of the abuse that politicians get and all of that kind of stuff. And it's also really interesting, rewarding, and like kind of incredible job to be into. So I'm glad I didn't know all of it, and I would really recommend it to somebody who's thinking of it as well. But also there are times where it's not easy, for sure.
Your constituency office was targeted. Was that a particular low point?
A lot of the time as well, Sinead, it's like with when I have my team, like in Cork Southwest, and oftentimes it could be one person in the office or whatever. And when we've had like security threats, and we might get threatening stuff in emails, through the post, through social media, it's not really fair to ask staff to be in that position on their own too. So it was a combination of reasons why we unfortunately had to come to the decision to close the constituency office. But it's my responsibility to make sure that all of my team feel safe. So that's really important too. But we're working on ways to kind of find new ways to reopen, because I really want to have that back, just when the time's right and we have a few different things organized. So we'll see how it goes.
I feel like women in leadership is essential if we are going to reimagine anything going forward, because I feel like maybe up until now, while we have been given access to a man's world, we've been asked to perform as they do and think as they do and lead as they do, where really it's about thinking as we do. It's about seeing the problems in the way that we do. Perhaps having more empathy and compassion in the way that we do. I have seen you stand in the door and express those things in a way that I feel hasn't quite been done before. And I can feel it amongst women my age, a bit of a groundswell actually, because of it. An empowerment rising, because you have demonstrated, you have said the things that we are sharing in our own WhatsApp groups in a way that just isn't communicated by perhaps some that have been in politics for longer, that have kind of assumed the political language, that are afraid to speak as just a human.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. It actually gives me like little butterflies. It's so nice to hear. Makes it all kind of worth it sometimes to just get that kind of positive feedback. But yeah, like it is, to say that politics is a man's world is like, it's such an understatement. And I mean, just even to the extent that people in here can't even see it. Like when I first got elected, I remember I was on the Dáil Reform Committee, which is this committee set up of different members, and you like review the standing orders of the Dáil, which is like the rules of the house, like when the Crown would intervene and that kind of thing. And like Sinead, the whole way through it said chairman. The whole way through it didn't acknowledge that like women might be on the chair of a committee, the Count Corla, like anything. And so one of the first things I did when I came in was I said, like, can we change the standing orders to acknowledge that women exist? And put chairperson or cahir look in the whole way through, because it doesn't have to be gendered, you know. But that's just one thing, and nobody could even see that had been, you know what I mean. And then, like, and at the time, like, I'm the only woman elected in Cork. It just seems sometimes it's wild. Like, we'd have these HSC meetings for Cork. You get all of the TDs and senators could meet with the kind of officials in the HSC to go through particular issues. And remember, it was during the time of the pandemic, and waiting there, like, they're long meetings, and I was one of the last ones who got to contribute, and, like, very honoured to raise the issues. But I was like, how is I the only one raising the maternity restrictions? How is I the only one raising the lack of beds for eating disorders, medication for hyperemesis? Like, you know, and you can just see this, like, big gaping hole of where we need more female representation. And then, of course, like, the difference, like, saying how women get on kind of in those leadership roles. And I remember in that same first year, a member of a state board called me an ignorant little girl online. So, like, from everything, just from the kind of the structures that are in place, like that, the standing orders where they just hadn't even noticed that they didn't mention women, to attending those kind of, like, really important meetings as a public representative, to the kind of treatment you get from, for example, a state board. I mean, it's wild.
But it's so belittling, you know, and it's deliberate. And I suppose the more you provoke it, the more it demonstrates that they might be just afraid of you. But surely there are times, particularly in the beginning of your career, when we all feel a little bit, you know, out of our comfort zones. You know, how have you learned how to process and to filter, I suppose, to process and to filter, you know, what could be useful feedback, and to filter what is deliberately there actually to put you back in your place?
That's a pretty good question. I think, like, in reality, a lot of it comes down to having such an amazing team who are helpful for filtering that. Because obviously it's so easy to take things personally. And if you've got people around you going, like, that's, you know, that's pure sexism, or that's, you know, this or that, and, like, actually this is something we need to really consider, like, that's a really good point. Or I think it's just that kind of bouncing off the other women that I work with all the time, that I find them amazing and really helpful, so supportive, because there are times that I find it difficult, and they're, yeah, just amazing. I feel so lucky with the team that I have, and that's probably, in reality, the way that I filter it is by other people's judgment and people that I really trust in terms of their opinion. Because, yeah, sometimes I think it can be kind of easy to take things personally, because you know yourself, like, sometimes I feel so resilient, and that could be like, oh, it's like water off a duck's back to me. And then other days, not at all. And it's like, is it, you know, you just don't know what it is. And like, for example, at the beginning of this week, there was an email that came in, and at the end of the email, it said something like, my next step will be doorstepping you at your home or something. And straight away for me, that, like, I mean, maybe, like, kind of knocked down my shield or something, and I felt very kind of shook or a bit vulnerable or something. So that anything after that maybe is a little bit harder to, like you say, decipher.
Yeah.
Constructive criticism and a fair contradiction of your political stance, or nasty sexist trolling, you know. Sometimes those things are obviously very clear what's what, but other times you just need good advice.
It's a really good example, though, because that, to me, even as you said it, makes me feel vulnerable at a physical level. Like, I feel somebody coming at my home, and I suppose that is the blur between where we have come because of digital and because of social, that the lines have been so blurred between, I suppose, the boundaries that we can have with people that are not just in positions of leadership, but just in positions of visibility. But even as you said that, you know, that alarm went off inside me.
Yeah, me too. I certainly felt it. Yeah. And I think probably, like, for men, they probably do have it, they must have it to a certain extent. Anybody can feel kind of vulnerable, I would imagine. But I think probably there's different kinds of abuse targeted at women, different kinds of threats targeted at women comparatively to men. Because, like, I suppose that kind of treatment of politicians on the whole is an issue. And then there's a particular gender type, which is a part of that issue. Like, you could see that even with Taoiseach yesterday. I think he really meant it when he was saying, like, politicians are human. And I think maybe, you know, I think it does have an impact across the board. Yeah, but certainly varies in its, in the language, I think, that's used towards men and women.
One of the main issues that I think that you have shown a resounding compassion for from day one has been Gaza. Your expressions were human, and your expressions were that I felt demonstrated that real feminine power. And I don't mean feminine power as in any kind of weaker sense. I mean that in a space of, we need to stop talking about ego and we need to start actually just saving people that are vulnerable.
Yeah, I mean, there. I feel like I've run out of words for speaking about Gaza because it's just so horrific and the inaction is so indefensible and indescribable. And yeah, all of the different things that seem to be weighing on how people approach it is, I think that's really depressing because it feels like there's kind of vested interests that weigh on that, or other pressures like not wanting to be like so out of step with Europe and all of these things that, like, in the context of a child being murdered every 10 minutes don't matter. So it is really, I think, difficult to, like, watch politicians on that issue. And I just think, like, I always come back to this in my mind when I'm thinking about Gaza. Like, in 1984, in Dunn stores, workers there refusing to stock the products that were being imported in from apartheid South Africa. And that actually being the start of a movement that ended the apartheid there. And it's just this kind of, like, lack of acknowledgement that you can't underestimate the impact that a small country can have on an issue like this. And Ireland is unique in its position of being neutral, of having experienced, you know, colonization and war and peace and all of these things, and this kind of reluctance to use all of the levers available to us to help people in a scenario that we can get to grips with and understand with, because of our unique history. It's just so disappointing. To be fair, Ireland's words have been strong and we can see that that has an impact. So it just goes to show, if we did a bit more, what more of an impact we could have. But I mean, it's just, it's one of those issues that, like, you can nearly see how it's going to go down in history now. Like, what was everyone doing when this was happening? And so I think, like, I just, like, would be into the doll in despair. Like, why are we having these conversations? Why isn't more being done? But it's those kind of things that just, it would drive you more to keep going and to try and get more people into politics who are coming from that kind of position and that kind of viewpoint, because that is just what we so desperately need. And it's kind of, it can be really frustrating that we aren't doing that now, but also, like, it's such an advantage that we can, we are in charge of how our country is run by virtue of who we elect to run it. And we've never really had much of a choice because of our unique history that we kind of just touched on, that our civil war politics, it's kind of quite understandable that we've always had this kind of, you know, Fianna Fáil family or Fine Gael family and all of this kind of stuff. But now we are moving away from that. And I think this is the time people are starting to kind of ask, what type of change do we want? The tide is turning, change is coming. And I think I just have to keep, like, going to that when there are these times, because that's the aim. That's what we have to keep focusing on. Otherwise, it's easy to, like, despair, I think.
And despair we have been in, you know. I have felt that despair. I have felt that anger. But I have learned so much not just about, I suppose, look, you can say you learn about the geopolitical, all that stuff, but I have learned about the ethics of politics. And I have been shown, I suppose, and I don't feel like I'm alone in this. I feel like there has been a bit of an uprising amongst women my age, our age, you know, that is seeing how our morals and our politics aren't aligned. And we don't want our children or our children's children to be part of that future. You know, I don't want my children to have to exist in a world where their international humanitarian rights have been so eroded that it is now their job to fix. And I feel like that's represented in the marches. You know, I've never felt politically motivated enough to attend marches like I have over the last few months. But something that has stood out to me, and I could, and I'm saying this, I could be wrong, because as I said, I haven't been to ones in the past, but the proportion of women to men, the proportion of women to men at the marches every week is dramatically, I feel, in towards women. It is women who are marching on behalf of those mothers. It is women who are marching on behalf of the rights of those children. And I think that it has triggered something inside of us that refuses to roll back into, you know, and we use it kind of a patriarchal society or, you know, hyper-capitalist and let's all get rich and burn the earth, you know, and we kind of sleepwalked into that for a while. But I really feel like this issue for a generation of women will have completely changed actually their viewpoint on not just politicians, but on our world and how it all works and what we want to be a part of.
I think that's it. And I, like, you know, like from following like UN Women and all of these different things that I've always kind of followed online, and I've seen things like wars disproportionately negatively impact on women and stuff like that. And I've never, like, honestly, never quite understood that, in that I'd be like, men are more likely to be sent out, you know, to fight and all of these things. And now it's like in this age where we can actually see what's happening in Gaza on our phones, like on Instagram and all of this stuff. It's like, it is the harrowing scenes of mothers and their babies. And I think that, you know, Emma Blake, the artist, did the image of the woman like with her child, and I just think that, like, you know, brings like tears to my eyes. Yeah. any of those kind of images that we can all probably remember the rest of our lives that we've seen online since the war broke out, I think that you're right, it has really, like, my sister is really not political. Like, she wouldn't normally, you know, just from, say, on social media, sort of share anything. And she has just recently had a baby. It's the first baby in our family. So to say we're all obsessed is an understatement. But it was so, like, interesting for me to even see her sharing stuff about Gaza and, like, something like, how can this be, you know, these children, these, and, like, the profound impact for her seeing that and, like, having her own son there and imagining it. Like, it's just, I think you're completely right. It has, is one of those things that has really struck a chord in terms of the need to get out, take to the streets and do everything we can. And I would love to say to, like, any of your listeners who are going to those protests, and, like, I'm from a really rural area in Cork Southwest, every week there's candlelit vigils in villages and towns, like, across the country, not to mention the tens of thousands of people taking to the streets of Dublin and all of the other cities in the country. It has such a big impact. You know, we're talking about those Dunstores workers, like, please keep going out and protesting, because even, like, it's something in our private members business, lots of Social Democrats, we bring forward motions to try and get the government to act, to use more of the levers available to them. I raise it at leaders' questions, and, like, all of that drives me to do that. So just to your listeners, to not, like, underestimate the impact of what you're doing when you get out or when you share stuff online, when you contact your TDs, like that has such a strong impact on the decisions that are made in here. And I certainly didn't realize that until I came in here myself and saw how it all operated and what pushes action, what causes that, what makes the government change their mind. It's the people. So,
and I think that's been the most frightening thing, I think, over the last few months. I suppose we've been raised probably through Hollywood movies of assuming that the good guys would swoop in at some point and save the day. And that good guy was always represented as the US president. And actually to see the US veto again and again and again, any hope of saving those lives was a real moment of, I think, destruction for people's sense of safety and even just identifying with, God, I thought I knew how this worked. Have you learned incredible things over the last few months around actually how does the world work?
Completely. And actually, honestly, even when you said that about the good guy in the movie, like just on a very kind of like peripheral level, I think all my life, like those men on the election posters and those men in suits on the TV, like I thought they kind of had things under control.
Yeah, same.
By virtue of that, like even the outfits and the posters and the like way of speaking and all of the stuff, and like to just realize that they're just normal people who don't necessarily have the right approach, the right idea, the right interests in mind, and all of those things. Like even that in and of itself is such a, I mean, realistically obvious thing, but not something that I'd ever thought about or really realized. And I think the kind of the crash was a bit of a moment of realization in relation to that. But even after that, for me, just that has been a learning curve. And I think also just that what I was saying about the impact of, say, people getting onto us about things. So like people get onto me about issues in my constituency, could be personal issues about, you know, access to health services, or could be like something to do with Gaza. And all of that that's coming into my office and coming into me is like, if I agree and think that's a really important issue, well, then I'm likely to raise it. And I just didn't necessarily realize that that's how it all works. But then in addition to that, what happens particularly to all TDs, but particularly to the ones in government, is you get lobbied. And the big financial successful sectors have huge lobbying influence because they pay full-time lobbyists. They're organized, they're meeting TDs, they're giving them the language, the insight, the perspective, and then they're going in and parroting that on the media, in the Dáil, in the cabinet table, you know, whatever it is where the decisions are made. And something I learned almost like as soon as I went into politics was that like, oh right, so the women who are coming into me whose children are disabled or have a disability, they don't have an organized lobby. Clearly, they can barely find the time and the childcare and the support to come in and have this meeting with me in my constituency office. But the women who are just about to give birth and are stressed because they're going to have to go in on their own, don't have their partner with them because of the pandemic rules, even though you can go to the pub with your partner at this point, bear in mind, you know, all of these different things. I'm like, those are the groups that don't have that organized lobby, and the profound impact that has then on the action on those issues. Like the Ventnors, and that's nothing against the Ventnors, all the pubs and that, they had a strong lobby during the pandemic. And where was the lobby for pregnant women?
Our bodies are designed to grow. They stretch and soften in ways that we are told we should reject and shame, when really they are doing the most amazing job. And it is okay to also want to reclaim your confidence, to encourage good posture, to create shape and support beyond birth for as long as you choose. The Carrywell Back to You collection features a seamless shapewear nursing top and organic cotton belly binder, both designed to hold you as you recover, support your lower back, improve your posture, and create smooth lines on those days that you want that extra confidence. Embrace the stretch of motherhood confidently with Carrywell. Available to buy now on cleverclogs.ie and check out your nearest stockist.
Do you think there needs to be more transparency around that lobbying? Do you think that you know, the population needs to be more aware that, well, this sector has this lobby and this sect and that lobbyist is talking to this minister and this minister and this minister X amount of times this month? Or how do you think that we can, I suppose, make us all more cognizant of the fact that that is how it works?
To be honest, there actually is a lobbying register. And so all of that is registered, but there's no real awareness around that and the impact of it. Because I was the same, like, hang on, this should be documented. Yeah. Like, oh, right, it is.
Oh, it is. And still nothing. Oh, okay.
So there is a lobbying register, but like, I guess it's not really highlighted as much as it should be.
Is that a media issue?
I'm not sure where the issue lies with that. I think it's like, it's not news to the media either. Like, they know that there isn't organized lobby groups in the same way for disabled people, for pregnant women, for all of those kind of things. And it's just kind of like, not that they agree with it, they just know that that's kind of the norm. But I suppose, like, we just need, like, it shouldn't really matter what lobbying you get in terms of if you have principles that are committed to protecting vulnerable people, for example, to creating a more equal society, things like that, that, like, you know, like, people can lobby you all day about things, you don't have to agree with them. And I think that's kind of the crucial missing part of this puzzle, do you know?
Do you think the recent referendums was a signal of that, that actually maybe we do have lobby groups, it's just that it's us together as an electorate?
Yeah, like, the people can speak like with our vote and our feet, and that's so important to remember and to recognize. It's hard to know, like, with the recent referendum, because there's so many different campaigns, and obviously every campaign is kind of coming from a very different perspective. But from start to finish, like, they can't say we didn't warn them. I mean, for one, doing that on International Women's Day was the most pathetic PR stunt. Do you know what I thought? I was saying at the time, we're going to have an election in March. There's no way they think it's a good idea to have that on International Women's Day. They're just pretending. So it's all set up for an election on that day. They can't think that that's a good idea and that all the women of Ireland will be so grateful to them. But they did. So I don't know. And then they, like, guillotined the debate. They didn't take the recommendations from the Citizens' Assembly. So there's so many different moving parts to the referendum result that it's hard to kind of decipher the main. I don't think there is a main. I think there's several reasons.
I mean,
but a lot of it is a kicking to the government.
Having the schools close on International Women's Day, forcing.
Hilarious. They hadn't even thought of that.
One parent go home. I did a poll with my followers on Instagram. It was the mothers on International Women's Day who were back doing the caring responsibilities. But
you couldn't write it.
You couldn't write it. No, you couldn't. You honestly could. And I can almost see the wheels of motion of how they thought maybe this was a solid plan. And if there had been more women of school going age children in the room that day,
exactly,
they might have alerted them to the fact that a lot of the voting polling stations happen to be in schools. And what would that do then to the schools? But we do have to say that the Social Democrats did encourage a yes, yes vote.
Yes. So when they brought the wording to the Dáil, we proposed alternative wording. So to recognise care in the home and in the community. And that's what was recommended by the Citizens' Assembly. And the government rejected our wording. It was voted down. And then we were left with the decision of, do we support their alternative wording or not? And we deliberated for quite a while. And then we decided to vote yes, because we thought removing the misogynistic language from the constitution was better than leaving it there. And that some reference to care was better than leaving it there. But we made clear in Dáil statements and everything that it would be the least enthusiastic yes vote we could muster up, that it was a binary choice between those two things. But I mean, I think it was quite clear from the last week in the referendum anyway, that there was no way that was going to pass. They should have just gone further, accepted the wording of the Citizens' Assembly, and they didn't. But it is like sad to think that now we still have that misogynistic language. But at the same time, I can see that like, go further. No, we're not going to let you away with it. And too right, you know?
In hindsight, would you have done it differently? Would you have actually said, no, we don't believe it has gone far enough. We don't believe that this language is the right language, and therefore don't vote this into the Constitution?
Well, we'd said all of that except don't vote for it. So we thought it was the wrong language, proposed the alternative wording. But our decision was that the binary choice we had, we didn't have a choice with our wording anymore. They voted that down, that was better than leaving the existing. And it's tricky. I think I would kind of stick to that position, to be honest. But the one thing that afterwards, and it was really in the final few days of the debate that came more to the fore, and it's an area I've done loads of work in terms of disability, is that position informed by the lived experience of disabled people saying, well, enshrining into the Constitution care in the home then takes away potentially a right to live independently. And I think it was a very kind of rush that was towards the end of the whole situation that I should have given that more consideration. I fully acknowledge that. I think it's really important too in politics. And that whole aspect of the debate being guillotined in the way that it was, normally there's more debate time because they were so insistent on having it on International Women's Day, was a real shame because it stifled that level of debate that we really needed. And instead that was all in the final kind of week. Then there's a lot of, you know, a lot of disabled people I know and have worked with were in favour of the wording too. So it's not fair to say that that's the only position of the disability sector. But yeah, it was a really kind of complex referendum and people were coming from a lot of different positions. So it wasn't easy to form our position, but I would stand by it.
No, it was a difficult few weeks to, because like you, I suppose from day one, I would have felt like, yes, get rid of that misogynistic language. But it wasn't until I studied actually what they wanted to replace it with that I felt I also don't want that written into my constitution.
Yeah.
And I also feel like the placement of it in International Women's Day can often assume that as women, we are now, like, our goal is to be in corporate and out of the home, and that very masculine view of what success looks like.
Yeah.
Instead of actually saying that for those that choose to be in the home as full-time carers for their family is also success.
100%. Yeah.
And
for men and women.
For men and women.
Yeah.
And I can never understand how they didn't just neutralize the genderized language in it and leave it as it was. Like, and it would have sailed through. It seemed like
there were a number of options, or to just recognize care in the community, that the state should have an obligation to provide it, because it should. Because there's such a difference, I think, between the different types of care that we need throughout our lives. Like, as a child, if you have a disability, you're disabled, it's so different. Because if there's, you know, that right to live independently that you may not want to be cared for in the home for your whole life is such a crucial, fundamental human right. And why didn't they just, include care in both, or just change the misogynistic nature of the language? Why switch it to what they did? It was, such a disaster.
Why do you feel, we may not have time to fully get into all of this, but on the one hand, if you're to look at any kind of economic media when it comes to Ireland, we're like this thriving success and everything is rosy. And yet, from even just, I went to something this week, which was a study done on how parents are navigating the various crises that we exist, whether it is a housing crisis, a childcare crisis, or a cost of living crisis. But that it's not reaching, you know, it's not going deep enough. That success, that economic, financial success, is not reaching the majority of the citizens of Ireland in a very meaningful way that makes them feel as though the hard work that they put into their careers or their repayments or their educating their families or even being able to afford families. I've had many conversations with people who would like to have that second child, but simply cannot afford the second child care fees. There was also a report I was listening to the radio this week, and another report kind of damning how our population, our youth population, is so in decline, and we won't have enough of if we're not having enough babies now, there will nobody to be in employment paying for our pensions as we age, etc. And it being placed down to, oh, sure, everyone's going off to Australia and having a lovely time for it, and that's why and stuff. And you're like, well, yeah, but it's also because you can't access childcare and you can't keep your career. And yet the bank says we need to have two mortgages in order to have a home. And one parent can't step away. And just no one's joining the dots around what it takes to actually function as working families in a real society and what needs to be put in place in order to. And we're not looking for any kind of handout kind of situation. We are just looking for a society that simply just operates.
100%. And I think this comes down to an approach of valuing public service. But in terms of childcare in particular, like, our public services leave a lot to be desired, but childcare is not considered a public service at all. It's completely provided by the private sector. And there, I honestly believe as well that there's going to be no such thing as gender equality until that there is a publicly funded childcare model. And there's no attempt to really fully reach that. And that is just an ideology. It's a left-right thing. It's a, you know what I mean? Further right, leaving everything up to the private market, and then the private market solve issues like health not working, housing not working, childcare that never worked. So the fundamental approach is the flawed aspect to this. And obviously, when you're in a country where we have this private market, there's people who've set up their lives and livelihoods around providing that, and they are private providers. So switching to a publicly funded model is not easy. It's not straightforward. But I honestly don't think that's an argument for it not to be done. It absolutely has to be done. So even, say, in our alternative budget, because like you say, at the moment, the economic success of the country, like, when there's an 8 billion euro surplus, there's potential to make lasting changes to really profoundly have an impact on people's day-to-day lives like that. So in our alternative budget for this one, when there's the 8 billion euro surplus, was to put aside 500 million to start acquiring, so the state buying those privately provided childcare facilities off the private providers and start to run them as state-owned and work towards genuinely free childcare in the future. Because it has to start somewhere and it does require big investment. That's the kind of money we have available to us now to start. Wouldn't happen overnight. Even, say, for people our age and our children wouldn't necessarily benefit from it, because these things don't happen really quickly, but as soon as possible. And we always have to try and make things better for the next generation. I really think that's what we should be working towards. So it's that approach, and we see it like the governments we've had, and it is unique that we've never had like a left and a right to vote between. We've always had, you know, on this side of the Civil War and on this side of the Civil War. And it means we've never had these kind of other alternatives that would build those public services. Like, that is the fundamental principle of social democracy, that like healthcare is free at the point of need. It doesn't depend on how one child is more or less entitled to healthcare based on how deep their parents' pockets are. But when you have those free services, like every other country in Western Europe has free healthcare at the point of the need, I think it's important to add, because in Ireland it feels like a far-flung dream that you wouldn't pay 50 euro to see the GP, that you wouldn't be on a waiting list or paying privately. These are just the things we're so used to, and we kind of like, how could you ever afford anything else? We spend more per capita on health than those other countries. It's all just being funneled into the private market, private interests, personal financial gain for a small few people. And that's a Fine Gael ideology, essentially, to privatize everything. Not everything, but way more than we would. And ultimately, this is where it has gotten us. And potentially there are some other benefits to that that from my position I don't appreciate or see, you know, to a certain extent. But I just think we have to work towards that, because if your taxpayers' money goes into free education, free childcare, all of those things that are the basic kind of human needs, then it brings down everyone's cost of living too, because you don't have to pay, you know, we say we have free education now, but we don't. There's still fees, there's still books, there's still uniforms, there's all of these things that are a huge cost. Healthcare, VHI, like all of this stuff, it brings down people's quality of life so much because the rest of your income is so kind of beaten down. And then throw our disastrous housing situation into the mix, it is just driving people out. And like when we see this 21,000 visa applications for Australia last year, that's not just the number of people who want to go and spend some time in Australia. It's people driven out because of all these things, because of housing. And we know that from the 2008 crash. We all remember it. So much of our family, our friends still living abroad from that time. That's the reality. And it really doesn't have to be that way. There are other ways of doing it. We've just 100 years now, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, we've never had an alternative. So that's like our whole focus at the moment, is to just try and build. We're obviously small, new, but we're doing what we can to try and put those messages out there, because it's obviously, how long did that take me? It's a much more convoluted thing than like vote for tax cuts and then you don't have healthcare, childcare, free education, like all of these things.
So it has been quite the journey since you have decided to join this political world. Were you surprised at how quickly you became head of the party? Maybe not surprised, but it certainly didn't seem like it was your outstanding ambition, which is a massive stretch, a personal stretch, an identity stretch, to become, you know, to what was, you know, Holly doing her career, to all of a sudden, wow, I'm in this very visible, very important and very potentially significant opportunity to actually create positive change.
Yeah, like it has been such a roller coaster. It's all been in the space of about 4 years. So like in many ways, honestly, Sinead, I'm like, I feel like I haven't had time to stop and like reflect on how much of a journey it's been. But like, you know, the way even you just get like Facebook memories and stuff like that. Sometimes in those moments, I'm like, oh my God, like, because I always think back to my first ever election in 2019, like that after repeal, I wasn't going to go for the election. And like, obviously, even in the newspaper when they were covering those elections, they didn't bother mentioning me. And when we asked, they were like, she doesn't have a hope. So like the local newspaper just didn't include me in the paragraph about my electoral area. And like, I lost by one vote and then called a recount and won by one single vote.
Wow.
So when I think back to that, because if I didn't get that
real sliding doors moment, like,
isn't it? If I didn't get that one vote, I wouldn't have had the platform to run for the Dáil. It was only like 8 months later or something that the general election was called a snap election. And it was the same then. I was laughed at and told I wouldn't get a seat. And we got it. And then to be, like you say, now in the position of leader of the party, that it's when I see those Facebook memories of that recount, those days of the recount, and that one vote that got me in, that's when I really realized like all of the kind of butterfly effect after that, and just how important each individual action, small thing is. It almost gives me like a shudder. But apart from that, I feel like I haven't fully stopped to reflect on it. But the main reason, like, that there's, I don't want to say someone like me, but you know what I mean? It's like this, it's not really the norm to have the like a younger woman from a rural constituency in the position of the leader of the party, is, to be quite honest, a credit to the party that was set up by Catherine and Roisin. And I think there's something to be said for the kind of approach of two women setting up a party. And like, you know, we often get asked questions like, oh, why don't you merge with this party, merge with that party? And it might sound insignificant, but it is not the culture within a party. Like, if equality doesn't even exist in your party, how can you claim to be able to govern in a way that does? And like, we're the only party that returned more women than men after the last election. Mm. We're the only party that has a gender balance in our councillors. And I just think like, people wondering like, how did that fully happen with Holly going from boom, boom, boom? It's a credit to Catherine Roisin. They've set up this party that is very different in its culture and in our way. And it's not particularly hierarchical. And it's very collegiate and everybody actually gets on. Nobody's knifing anybody in the back. And I think that is, in some part, a lot to do with being maybe a new organisation as well, that we don't have institutional ways that we're stuck in. But I think there is something there in that approach that women take that is maybe different and, in my experience, profoundly positive in politics. And so, you know, oftentimes like that, you'd see the things the member of the state board say to me, for example, people like, how do you stick it up there? And I'm like, because when we're in our parliamentary party, when we're up here where I am now, where our offices are and stuff, I'm not the, you know, like when I'm at a meeting with the Cork TDs, I'm not the only woman in the room, the opposite. So I think that is a huge part of it. Credit to Catherine and Roisin, and as well for starting a political party, like, not an easy thing to do. They're two amazing women.
And I want to thank you for your time today on what was, as you said, an earthquake of a week. It's a Friday afternoon. I hope you have some downtime and replenishment planned, but I'm not sure that exists in modern politics for the weekend ahead. I do appreciate your time, and most importantly, I do appreciate your voice in the Dáil. I appreciate what you are fighting for, and most importantly, how you continue to express it in a way that is genuinely giving people some hope of empathetic leadership in a world that seems to have just gotten so cruel. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast today. I'm so grateful.
Thank you, Holly, for giving me your time no less than 48 hours after Leo resigned with all that was going on. And so that's it. Another season of Stretch Marks wrapped up. We talked about our bodies, our fertility, self-worth, mental health, hyperemesis, NICU, the referendum, brain tumours, nervous system regulation and leadership. Big topics, deep topics. But I hope topics that will have supported those that needed these conversations. So for now, thank you for listening. Talk to you soon.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.